The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I am Ben Rhodes, and this is a special episode with so much attention on the situation in Ukraine and so much speculation. And frankly, with the U.S. president being pretty forthright in saying that he thinks Russia is not only going to invade Ukraine, but try to conquer Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. We thought that it would be important to give you an update here. So later in the show, we are going to hear from an extraordinary frontline reporter who's on the ground, literally along the front lines in eastern Ukraine, Christopher Miller from BuzzFeed. And we're going to unpack with him what the scenarios there are on the east, what he's watching, what the recent developments are. Because a lot of what has taken place in the last just couple of days, and I'm talking to you Saturday morning here, has felt like exactly the pretext for war that Vladimir Putin would set up in eastern Ukraine. So just to summarize here, because there have been a flurry of reports in the last day or two, the pro-Russian separatist leaders of these breakaway regions of Ukraine, Luhansk and Donetsk, have made a series of announcements. They've ordered the evacuation of civilians to Russia on Friday, accusing Ukraine of planning a large-scale military offensive. You saw women and children beginning to be bused into Russia. And you also saw Vladimir Putin indicating that Russia was prepared to provide support, including 10,000 rubles to these refugees coming into Russia. And so that felt like there was some pre-planning behind this. There are also metadata that was analyzed of the videos that these leaders released that suggested that even though they were acting like they were responding in real time to events, that these videos were recorded as long as a couple days ago. So it definitely feels staged, definitely feels pre-planned, definitely feels like what the Biden team was warning about. This continued to escalate into today as those leaders called for a mobilization of all military age men in those regions. So if you're a guy from 18 to, I think, 55, you can't leave because you're being called up to serve in the war. If you're anybody else, I think, you can get out. Meanwhile, Russian television is kind of in a frenzy, reporting on ethnic cleansing, genocide against Russian speakers or ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine. Again, another very likely pretext for war being that Russia has to protect these people from the Ukrainians. Obviously, these reports aren't true, but we've seen also some things getting blown up in eastern Ukraine. One, for instance, being the car of one of these Russian separatist leaders, kind of felt very much like a staged assassination attempt that they were trying to show the world or show on Russian television, at least. So that's what's going on in eastern Ukraine that feels like this pretext. Meanwhile, Russian President Putin on Saturday presided over the test launching of three ballistic and cruise missiles that were part of what was called a nuclear deterrence exercise. So kind of flexing, reminding the world that Russia is a nuclear power. He was joined by the president of Belarus, President Lukashenko, kind of his supplicant in the room at the time. Should note, importantly, Lukashenko and Belarus officials are now announcing that Russian troops will not leave Belarus as planned under Russia's military exercises. So the idea that this has all been an exercise, nobody's even making that excuse anymore. The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Saturday that he felt it's clear Russia had made a decision and was moving its military into positions to conduct an attack on Ukraine. He said, quote, they're uncoiling and now poised to strike. The diplomacy continues insofar as there's diplomacy, and that a lot of center of gravity there has been at the Munich Security Conference, where Vice President Harris is leading the U.S. delegation, vowed in a speech that there will be swift, severe, and united response if Russia invades Ukraine, made mention of certain sanctions, including on Russian banks. Ukraine's President Zelensky flew to that summit. We'll see if he gets back into Ukraine, kind of a risky decision by his part. He kind of doubled down while he was there on Ukraine's desire to join NATO. So no indication that he is backing down on Russia's core demands. But the most dramatic statement, I think, of the last day was President Biden speaking from the White House late yesterday afternoon, in which he was as forward-leaning as he's been to date about what he thinks is happening. Let's give it a listen.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. We're calling out Russia's plans loudly and repeatedly, not because we want a conflict, but because we're doing everything in our power to remove any reason that Russia may give to justify invading Ukraine and prevent them from moving.
Okay, so that was not a particularly caveated statement, you know, and what he's describing there is the worst case scenario, which is a Russian invasion that's not just the kind of escalation in eastern Ukraine that I'll be talking about with Christopher Miller here in a minute, but rather the full-scale invasion, the toppling of the Ukrainian government, the conquering of, as President Biden reminds us, a city of nearly 3 million people, which would mean a lot of suffering, a lot of death. What are the key takeaways for me from the last 48 hours? Number one, it just feels like this thing is happening. And here's why. First, because as I alluded to earlier, this is precisely the pretext that Putin would use to justify an invasion. And you kind of heard, you've heard everybody from Tony Blinken to Jake Sullivan to Ned Price, the State Department spokesperson, speaking about exactly these types of scenarios, kind of staged attacks in eastern Ukraine where the Russians control some space, right? So they can blow up some infrastructure themselves and claim that the Ukrainians did it, and then they can gin up their propaganda machinery. And if you're thinking to yourself and watching this, this is pretty hackish, right? Like these dudes are taping videos days in advance and they're not trying that hard to make the pretext look real to independent observers, you know, like you. I think an important thing to note there is that Putin may not just give a shit how effective his pretext looks, right? I mean, I credit the Biden team for being out in front and putting all this information out to make it harder for Putin to run a play for a global audience that suggests that you know, that Ukraine was semi the aggressor. But we also have to remember that Putin may not care anyway. You know, he may not be deterred in any way by the fact that the U.S. is putting out its plans. And the fact that they're going ahead with the exact scenario that the U.S. has already blown the whistle on kind of demonstrates that not giving a shit, you know, and not giving a shit in general is one of Vladimir Putin's strengths and weaknesses. It is who he is, right? And so they seem to be running a play that they probably designed a few weeks ago, in terms of claiming genocide against ethnic Russians and making some things blow up and having these Russian pawns get out there and say that war has come and we have to fight back, and inevitably probably call for Russian support. That's what's worrying to me about it, is just how much they're not adjusting their plans because they feel like, you know, they were outed. They're just doing what they were probably planning to do all along if they wanted to have a ramp into an escalation. So that's the first point. I think the second point is when the President of the United States says that they're, you know, we have information they're going to take Kyiv, that is not a statement he would make if that was not, I think, a high confidence judgment of the U.S. intelligence community. I just say that as someone who, you know, consumed intelligence. It does not feel like he was speaking offhand or committing a gaffe here. The U.S. intelligence evaluates a lot of different things, and it's not just overhead imagery. You know, it's intercepted communications. It's analysis of what is flowing to the border. It's probably analysis of what, you know, Russian groups like the Wagner Group, that's, you know, the paramilitary outfit that Russia's used in the Middle East and Africa. Are those guys going back to the region? Are they going into eastern Ukraine? Are there Russian intelligence agents inside of Ukraine? And what are they doing? What are the pro-Russian Ukrainian politicians doing? All of these are the types of things that you would look at, never mind whatever intel you may be able to get on Vladimir Putin himself. And clearly this whole picture suggests to the United States an inevitability of the larger invasion. And so I think we have to take that seriously. And which brings me to the last point, which is diplomacy. And you heard Biden say, well, there's still a chance for diplomacy. And everybody says that, and they should, to the bitter end. Here's the problem. I don't know what the room is right now, because Russia issued its formal written responses to the U.S. written responses to the original Russian demands, right? And Russia reiterated in those written responses that Ukraine can never be a member of NATO, that these breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine essentially have to have a veto over all Ukrainian foreign policy, that NATO has to pull back from Eastern Europe, can't have any NATO presence in the Eastern European countries that joined NATO in the late 90s and early 2000s. That's the Russian position. Zelensky today reiterated that Ukraine wants to join NATO. NATO has actually increased the number of troops in Eastern Europe. As we speak, there are thousands of American troops in Poland who weren't there a couple weeks ago. So somebody would have to back down significantly here. You know, like either Russia would have to essentially, you know, give up on all of its demands around NATO and U.S. and NATO force posture, and just kind of act like these were all just a bunch of military exercises, and that the genocide of Russians in that they allege, it's not true, in eastern Ukraine is something that they're not doing anything about differently than they did before. Or Ukraine would have to completely change its position, say, no, we've actually decided we're not going to join NATO, or we're going to implement an agreement that allows these separatist regions to have a veto on our foreign policy, or the U.S. or other NATO countries would have to say that. And it just doesn't feel like that's happening. And so it's hard to see, you know, you look for those paths off like a highway into a war. And I just don't see the off ramps at this point. So I hope there are. For the sake of the people of Ukraine, for the sake of the world, for the sake of the consequences that I think we would even feel in the U.S. from this war, I hope it's the case that it doesn't happen. But it just certainly feels like this is where we're heading. That's one of the reasons why we had this episode. Now, one of the things I talked to Christopher Miller here about in a moment is that war could be the full-scale invasion and the effort to take Kyiv and all the rest of the consequences we got into a few days ago on the pod. Or it could be something that's much more Eastern focused. And I think it's important for us to hear that scenario, because that's quite possible as well. So when we come back, we'll have my interview with Christopher Miller from BuzzFeed.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation. Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, for many, many years now, because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Listen, if you're listening to Pod Save the World, you need some therapy. If you're watching the events around the world that might freak you out, we've got this election coming down the pike. There's a lot of stuff that people are stressed about, that are anxious about, stuff that makes you lose sleep, and therapy can help. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/crookedworld. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/crookedworld.
I'm very pleased to be joined now by Christopher Miller. He is a correspondent for BuzzFeed News covering national security and extremism. He's also a deep expert on Ukraine, and he is currently talking to us from Kharkiv, Ukraine, which is along Ukraine's eastern border. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's just start with, like, what have you been up to the last couple of days? It feels like, and we'll get into the fact that it feels kind of like the pretext that, you know, would have been the most likely one for Russia to gin up has been ginned up in the part of the world where you are right now in eastern Ukraine. But what have you been up to the last day or two? What have you seen? Who have you talked to?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the last, I would say, handful of days have felt much more intense than the last month. You know, there has been a sort of steady buildup of this tension leading to something, possibly an invasion, an incursion attack of some sort. You know, certainly, and I've been back here after living here for 11 years. I've been back here now for almost a couple of months, and you know, I've spent part of January on the front line, and then yesterday was back in the town of Marinka, which is just a few miles from Donetsk on the front line. And just between my first visit in this January and now, there has been a pretty steady increase in the number of attacks, artillery bombardments, the number of casualties on the front line. So we're seeing a pretty significant increase in fighting, which is different than we've seen in the past couple of years. I mean, throughout most of the pandemic and even a few years prior, it's been mostly a simmer on the front line. The front line has been static. Trenches have been dug. The line has not really moved since these Minsk agreements were signed back in February 2015. So for, you know, 7 years now, it's been a war of attrition, mostly trench warfare that sometimes resembles World War II. If you throw in some new technology like drones and some higher powered weapons, some more modern weaponry. But, you know, in Marinka, speaking with the soldiers there, speaking with the soldiers in three other frontline towns in January, everybody is saying that since November, when this Russian military buildup began, that the intensity has slowly increased. And now we are seeing an amount of shelling and an intensity in fighting that is more close to the type of heavy fighting that we saw in 2015, 2016. We're not quite at the level of all-out war that we saw in spring, summer of 2014, which was really intense, casualties, deaths in the dozens, if not hundreds, on an almost daily or weekly basis. And, you know, hopefully we don't get to that point. But there are a lot of people who fear we're heading in that direction, that if Vladimir Putin does decide to launch an attack, things could very quickly escalate and go beyond even what it looked like in 2014, which was, you know, indiscriminate, multiple launch rocket systems, artillery that's decades old and very imprecise. You know, there's a real fear here that higher tech weaponry and possibly even airstrikes could be used. And a lot of the talk among the military here has to do with the military materiel that the Russians are placing around the borders. For instance, I'm in the city of Kharkiv, like you mentioned. I'm only 20 miles from the border here. And just on the other side, you've got several battle tactical groups. These are battle-hardened soldiers that are ready for ground warfare. But you've also got attack helicopters in Belarus, which is just to the northwest of here, and in some places in Russia, also northeast of here, you've got besides these helicopters, you've got other attack aircraft. And so there is now this real sense of a major war looming in a way that the Ukrainians were much more skeptical about even weeks ago.
So tense. And in the last couple of days, what we've seen is the separatist leaders, and put that in kind of air quotes, but the Russian backed separatist leaders of Donetsk and Luhansk. These are the two territories of eastern Ukraine that Russia's kind of de facto tried to not annex, but at least carve out from Ukraine and use it as leverage to control Ukrainian politics. Those leaders made statements that there was a looming invasion coming from Ukraine. Then we saw what felt like staged efforts at sabotage attacks on infrastructure or assassination attempts in Luhansk and Donetsk. And then we heard calls for both refugee flows into Russia from women and children from Luhansk and Donetsk to kind of create the impression that these people are under assault. And then we heard about a military mobilization where kind of military-aged men are not allowed to leave those regions. What's going on? What is your read on this? And maybe explain to our listeners who might not follow the twists and turns of this too closely, like who are these two leaders, and on what basis do people kind of think they talk? Are they speaking for themselves? Are they mouthpieces for Putin? What do you make of these events?
Yeah. So plainly put, the leaders of the what are called the Donetsk and Lugansk quote unquote people's republics are
kind of throwback.
Right. Yeah. They are merely figureheads. Essentially, they are proxy leaders, working under the direction of Moscow. They, they're not the first leaders to be at the heads of these self-proclaimed republics, which really are, just occupied territories that Russia does control. I mean, Russia controls every element of, everything that happens within the Donetsk and Lugansk areas that are not controlled by Ukraine. And just to give you a sense of scale here, that's about the area that's under occupation right now is about the size of the state of New Jersey, maybe just a little bit underneath. So it's a large, this is a large, piece of land. These are not the first leaders. The previous leaders were assassinated under very murky circumstances. There are some people who believe Ukrainian special operations forces knocked them off. And there are others who believe that they had become a little too ambitious and that Moscow may have done away with them themselves. And so the leaders that we see now in Donetsk and Lugansk are people that have been handpicked by the Kremlin because they can be controlled. They're not ambitious. They merely want to behave as though they're these heads of states. In reality, these states are totally fictitious. Nobody in the world recognizes them, and Moscow controls every facet. And what we're seeing now in all of these reports that you mentioned about mass evacuations and attacks from the Ukrainian side on these territories are pretty classic examples of these disinformation campaigns that Russia and these republics use to try to paint Ukrainians as the ones that are wanting to go on the offensive, as the aggressors. They use words like genocide and toss them around like pretty willy-nilly. They say that Ukraine and the Ukrainian military is conducting a genocide of Russia, ethnic Russians and Russian-speaking people. And that is because Russia has handed out Russian passports to several hundred thousand people on these territories. And a vast majority of the people in eastern Ukraine speak Russian as their first language. Ukraine is a bilingual country, at least.
Yeah.
And
make clear that is not happening. You know, that
no, correct. And that's what I was going to say. Yeah. You know, this is not happening. Like, these are false flag operations. This is disinformation, and all of it is being done in order to try to create a pretext for a potential Russian invasion, a new Russian invasion. You know, creating these videos that several journalists and open source investigators over the last 24 hours have found to be made well in advance. The videos are being posted, and meant to show events in real time. In reality, they were filmed at least 2 days ago, which certainly suggests that this is some kind of disinformation campaign. And it's all being waged, you know, to justify a potential attack and to lay the groundwork for Russia to say, well, now we need to go in. We need to protect ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, which is something that Putin has said for years. You'll remember, I mean, back in 2008, 10, 12, 11.
That was the Crimea
pretext, Right, exactly. It's, you know, no matter where Russian speakers are in the world, we are the protector of Russian speakers. And so, you know, we will go anywhere they need protection and do whatever needs to be done. And so that's the kind of pretext that they're creating in order to be able to say this. You know, and we don't know if Putin has made that decision yet, but, you know, all of these reports are piling up now, and it may just be a matter of time before we sort of get to that threshold where, okay, now it's time to take that decision.
And I mean, it's hard to say what is the what here, because it could be, and we'll get into kind of a couple of scenarios. It could be kind of a much larger scale assault on Ukraine, taking out and disabling its, everything from its air defenses to its, energy grid. But if it's there, if it's concentrated there, it seems like the mobilization of what you were describing earlier, those attack helicopters, the use of air power, basically the use of the kind of weaponry and units that have not been a part of the fighting to date, that would be the sign that this is tipped over, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There are a lot of ways that this can go, and we can get into that if you'd like. You know, I mean, certainly the war in Donbass is where there could very well be an intensification at first.
Yeah.
And you know, setting things off there, we're in an already very heavily militarized and fortified area, would be a very easy way to just, you know, turn up the heat and get things started. But where people are really looking, and what they're really worried about is what's happening at Ukraine's northern border and to the south, where Russia has not only its troops on Crimea, but also in the Black Sea and naval forces in the Sea of Azov too.
Well, I wanted to ask you one question before getting to that potentially bigger scenario, which is, I think everybody, including President Biden yesterday, has been focused on the scenario where Russia makes a play for Kyiv and essentially is really trying to kind of conquer a chunk of Ukraine, overthrow the government and kind of control things entirely. There's always been like a potential for a more Eastern Ukraine focused scenario, you know, for instance, taking those two regions and kind of formally recognizing their independence or even annexing them, or moving in more Russian forces to kind of connect geographically Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula, to the parts of the Donbass that Russia is already in. Or even, you know, by the way, if they really want to, you know, make a play for the, you know, not that it has huge economic benefit, but if they really want to cement this kind of idea of Russian, ethnic Russian and Russian majority speaking territories being Russian, the city where you're in, Kharkiv, which is a big city, but is a predominantly, I think, Russian-speaking city. What do you, as someone who's covered that war for so long, what do you see as the Eastern focus scenario? If Putin ends up not going all the way into Kyiv, but wants to kind of solidify his position, what are the types of scenarios that you watch over there?
Sure, you know, there's what many people would be would consider the sort of like low-hanging fruit of these options, and that is just to really turn up the dial in eastern Ukraine, where there already is a war in these regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, and extend the territory there that is controlled to the full border, to the full region of Donetsk and Lugansk. Right now, if you think of Donetsk and Lugansk, they're called oblasts. If you think of them as states, right, about half of Donetsk and Lugansk states are occupied by Russia-controlled entities, and the rest are under Ukrainian-controlled entities. And in the Russian understanding, and in the understanding of the Russia-led separatist groups, all of Donetsk and Lugansk regions are, in their eyes, meant to be a part of their territory. So there are people who believe that, you know, trying to push through the Ukrainian lines and take over the rest of those two regions are a possibility. Now, to do just that, I find, you know, that it would be much more of a headache for Russia to focus really on those. Plus, you're not getting that much out of it in the end.
Yeah.
You know, this is the most militarized, heavily fortified part of Ukraine. You know, Ukrainian forces there greatly outnumber any other position and location in the rest of the country. And there's not a whole lot left in Donetsk and Lugansk oblasts that would really be worth taking. The main like key focus in Donetsk would be far, far, far to the southeast in the city of Mariupol, which is this really important port city for Ukraine that would allow Russia to then push a little further west toward Crimea and its Crimean forces to push east in order to create this land bridge. So if that is the goal, then, you know, we will see a lot of action in the south. I think the goal then would not be to take over necessarily all of Donetsk and Lugansk regions to the north, but to make a very serious push south, swinging west toward Crimea to create that land bridge. You know, it's if you look at where the forces are amassed, and they are everywhere, you know, around Ukraine, just about. But the other place is, you know, north and northeast of where I am in Kharkiv. And that could also play a role in this eastern scenario. And so, you know, Kharkiv is a city of a million plus people. It's known as Ukraine's second city. That's because it used to be a Ukrainian capital many, 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 you know, years back. But it's also heavily industrialized. They have a tank factory here. They've got other heavy industries. And there are there's a large population of Russian speakers. That's true. But you know, there are a lot of people who have family just across the border. You know, like I said at the top of this, that we're only 20 miles from the border here. And before the war began, people could very easily just come and go. You could go see your brother or your friend, you know, just for an afternoon and come right back. It would be it's easier than going from DC to Philadelphia. Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's now not the case. And, you know, the sort of relationship that people here had with Russia doesn't really exist. But there are still many people here, more in many other regions, that are sympathetic to Russia or not convinced that Kiev has their best interest at heart. And, you know, this could be a place where Russia believes they'll find fertile ground in fomenting, you know, unrest and attacking and trying to occupy Kharkiv. You know, I think they're wrong in that assessment, but they would, you know, they're not necessarily getting objective intelligence or information, you know. And so this is one area that people in the Ukrainian presidential administration and the military, and certainly people on the ground here, are very worried about being one of the first targets. You know, it's also not heavily fortified at the borders. You know, again, Donetsk and Lugansk Oblast, trenches, bunkers, I mean, major military bases and installations down there. And if Ukraine wants to wheel them out or needs to wheel them out, a lot of artillery, tanks, armor, that sort of thing. There's a presence of that here, but it's not going to be as much. Plus, you've got, you know, a border, an actual international border with Russia that is just not heavily fortified. The border guards there have dug tank trenches, but even, you know, in my interviews with them, they say these are really only meant to slow things down, to give us some extra time to, you know, call in help or, you know, notify whoever we need to notify that things are now starting to stream over the border. You know, so I think the eastern scenario is if you're looking just at Donetsk and Lugansk, I think there's not a lot in it for Russia if they just try to take those oblasts. If they want, if the goal is to create that land bridge to make things easier for you know, the residents of Crimea and for Russia to have you know, better transport there, to help funnel water there, and for other various strategic reasons, then I think, you know, that that point in the south is going to be key. They could also, you know, attack up here in Kharkiv just because of, you know, those many reasons that I said, but also to spread the military thin, right? That's the other thing that's being discussed. And it, this is, if it happens,
the Ukrainian
we
military.
Don't know. If it happens, one strategy could be to attack in multiple places in order to spread Ukraine's military thin and force it to respond in the north, in the east, in the south, which would also give Russia an advantage too.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I wanted to ask you, as someone who's kind of been there for, you know, really since, you know, off and on, but for the bulk of the time since this all started in 2014, you know, we've got people at the Munich Security Conference, including President Zelensky, you know, making speeches. You've got Vladimir Putin at, you know, very large tables with, you know, Lukashenko, and, you know, you've got all this geopolitical intrigue. But these are the people who live there, you know, in eastern Ukraine. What do they think about this? Like, are they sick of it? Are they, and I know you can't really generalize, but like, is the sense of like pride in that we are standing up for something here in eastern Ukraine? Is there a sense of some of the population is sympathetic to Russia and doesn't understand why Ukraine won't just say we won't join NATO? Or do they just not think about that because they're thinking about their daily lives and just hope that things don't get more violent? I mean, how would you describe the interactions with the people that are so absent from the kind of conversation about their future and all these, you know, high castles out there?
It's going to differ quite a bit depending on where you are in the country.
Yeah.
If you are, we can start in the war zone, for example, where I just was yesterday and have spent a significant amount of time since the war began. You know, people in eastern Ukraine are tired of the conflict. They want peace. And if, you know, I would say a majority of people you speak to on the ground will say they want peace on any terms. They've been living with war for 8 years. And that doesn't mean the, you know, the occasional shell falling nearby. Like, it is a militarized area. There is no local civilian government. It is a military government. They have to cross checkpoints every single day to go to the grocery store, to go to medical appointments. School buses, like the one that I saw yesterday, that was near this place where a shell had exploded and shrapnel sprayed this woman in her abdomen and her hand. Have to travel through checkpoints and through a street that is known as Sniper's Alley. You know, and there was a school bus with like 20 some odd children, and I found that really jarring. Like I was pulling out of the city shortly after an artillery bombardment, and there's this bus full of kids driving by. And you speak to the parents, and like I spoke with this woman whose third grade daughter goes to this school, and she started crying, became very emotional in talking about the threat of a larger war happening again. You know, she described 2014 and 15 as hell. And just being exhausted. And I put the question to her, like, are you even able to like think about the future, to plan for anything? And she says, on good days, I'm paraphrasing, on good days, I think about the future and I think about what my daughter could do and what she could be and where we could go if war ended. But there's no sign of the end of this war. Instead, we're talking about the possibility of it escalating and becoming much, much worse. Like the best option here seems to be almost the status quo for a lot of people, right? This slow war of attrition that escalates from time to time and then ebbs and is quiet for a couple of years. So that's what people in the East think. If you are in Kiev, the war can feel like it's really far away. It's a few hundred miles from the war zone. It feels, oftentimes like any other European city, everybody's going to the Philharmonic. You're going to the opera. People go to cafes, clubs. There's discos that go all night and raves that are some of the best in Europe. And they go on regardless of what the situation is like on the front line. I could list for you dozens of really fantastic restaurants that would be better than a lot of the places that you would go in Berlin or Paris even. These days, it's getting a little bit more tense. Like people are going to firearms training. They're learning first aid. They're learning self-defense. They're packing go bags so they can leave at a moment's notice. At the same time, they're calm. They're not panicking. And they are worried about what may or may not happen. But they want peace on Ukraine's terms. They don't want peace at any cost. They really do not want the West to push it into some kind of agreement with Russia. That would mean very serious concessions. That would mean pro-Russian politicians controlling the country or the territories of Donetsk and Lugansk in the East having some sort of veto power over what happens in the country's parliament. And, so they are ready to fight and resist. And I'm not talking solely about the military, but civilian people who are forming these territorial defense brigades, which are essentially just unofficial militias, even though there's now some control over them through city administrations. Their mood and views on this are a little bit different. And then the further west you go, the more like staunchly European you get. Like Lviv is this place where many people believe is safe haven and will go largely untouched if there is a large scale Russian offensive. And it's right there.
That's
on
where
the
U.S. embassies moved.
Hungary.
Correct.
Yeah. So the U.S. embassies, this small core team, is now based there. Same with the U.K. Yeah. Several other Western embassies. There are some international companies that have moved over there, and there are some Ukrainians who are packing up and leaving the East or the Northeast, where I am, or even in Kiev, and moving west to just temporarily relocate for a little while. And they are, I would say, even very anti-Russian, certainly anti-Putin, very patriotic, nationalistic in their viewpoints. And, they certainly want peace solely on Ukraine's terms. They are worried about what might happen, but they also feel as though they're very far away from the war. And I was just over there, and you know, there really was quite a difference, even from Kiev, in western Ukraine. That's changed in the last couple of weeks, just with the embassies, the Western embassies and U.S. embassy in particular, relocating people over there, and they're now talking about, you know, evacuation points and exits to the European Union. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a perspective of how things kind of swing east to west. You know, there is a scale, and you know, Ukraine is a really complex and much more diverse country than I think people give it credit for. And you know, there is no real easy way to sort of generalize things here.
So the last question for you is, you know, you clearly have like an investment in this place. You spend a bunch of time there. You clearly must know a lot of people there. What are your emotions like at this point? And what are your plans, you know, if things do escalate? I mean, how, put this into context for someone who may not know much about Ukraine. Like, why have you felt so attached to this place? And what's it like having felt that attachment to be in the moment that you're in?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, really invested in the story. I've been in Ukraine since March 2010. And, you know, I've made my career here. I've made a lot of friends here. I would really like to see this story out. And that could be, you know, a year down the road or many years down the road. I am so invested that I do hope at some point I will see some kind of resolution to the conflict. You know, I try to really focus on my work. That's not to be, you know, at the same time, like I'm not cold. I'm not, you know, stoic,
you have to.
You know, in the face of this. You know, it does affect me. And there are days where, you know, I feel it a lot more. You know, I have to take a few deep breaths and just remember to sort of like, you know, consider where I am and the situation that I'm in. I'm also not alone here. I have a small team, you know, that includes a fixer and a driver and a photographer, and I have to think about their safety. And so even if I might want to rush to, you know, someplace east or north to cover something, I have to consider, you know, the other people with me and what kind of danger and risk that poses to them. Something that's gotten to me a little bit more in the last couple of weeks is a lot of my Ukrainian friends reaching out to me for answers. What do you know that we don't know? What is going to happen? Where is it going to happen? How can we prepare ourselves? You know, for the most of the last few months, Ukrainians have been very calm. They haven't panicked. And if you speak to them about, you know, the latest Russian threat and the Russian buildup, especially in the context of Washington's messages and Western news coverage, they would kind of, you know, toss their head back, scoff maybe, and say, look, we've been living with war for a long time. We know how to deal with this. Like, just let us do our thing. But something shifted in the last week, maybe a little bit more. And they're really starting to, I think, to grasp the severity of the situation. Or, I mean, most of them knew that this was serious. But I think this, you know, maybe feeling as though we're edging much closer to something and the chances of it happening rising, they're getting nervous. They're calling me, they're writing me and asking, you know, what should we do? With like any advice. Yeah. And it's been tough to say, I really don't know. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. And I don't know what you should do. I think you need to think about what's best for you. And, you know, what is best for me is going to be very different than what is best for you, because I'm not trying to leave. I'm not planning an evacuation unless things get so very bad that I absolutely need to find a way out. You know, my role in this is to stay here, to observe, to report, and, you know, to stay alive and all of that. You know, I'm not a Ukrainian. I'm not a civilian. I don't have roots here. And,
you know, I tried to make that as clear as I can to my friends and provide them at least with the information that I can. you know, but ultimately it's up to them. And I think that's been one of the hardest things in the last couple of weeks that I've had to deal with.
I bet. Well, look, we appreciate you giving us your perspective, and you know, stay safe and well out there as you can. And you know, maybe we'll keep in touch here.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Christopher Miller for giving us that perspective. You can follow him not just at BuzzFeed, but he's a good Twitter follower, at Christopher JM. Thank you for tuning in here. We'll be back at our regularly scheduled program with, I'm sure, a lot more to talk about in a couple of days. See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Yale Freed, and Phoebe Bradford, who film and share our episodes as videos each week.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.